Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This week on Retronauts, Punk's Not Dead. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and today's topic is the No More Heroes series. Yes, we're doing a podcast about a franchise that started on the Wii. I think it's the first time we've done that so far, but again, the Wii is 14 years old this year, and we're going to be talking about the game that didn't, I don't think it put Suda 51 on the map, but it made the map available to more people. That is my kind of phrase I'm going with here. Before I continue any further, who is with us here today? Matt, I'll have you go first. Who are you exactly?
I am Matt McMuscles. You might remember me from the internet. I've been making content on said device, Information Superhighway, for the better part of 10 years, specifically for No More Heroes. I was actually a tester on the original version of it on the Wii.
Oh.
The company I was working for was contracted by Ubisoft because, and I quote, "No one at Ubisoft wanted to test the game."
It was surprising to me to go back and see, Ubisoft published this. It's a game that they would never publish today and probably didn't want to publish back then.
They definitely wouldn't publish it today, but I mean, we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
But I think at the time, yeah, you know, it was still within their kind of targeting reticle, that type of game. But yeah, and I've been a fan of the franchise ever since then. I've followed it very, very closely, probably too closely, because I've met Suda 51 two or three times now, and I think by the third time he like kind of rolled his eyes when he saw me. So yeah, that speaks a lot about my encounters with him. But yeah, really excited to be on the show today.
And this is your debut on Retronauts, Matt, so welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. I've been kind of Squidward looking down at everyone having fun on Retronauts.
We were all frolicking in the sand in front of your stone house there. Who is our returning guest of the show? You last heard her on the Super Mario RPG podcast almost 10 months ago. Who is our returning guest?
Hi, I'm Maddie Kopp. I'm a freelance artist. I've done a lot of art for some of the Talking Simpsons miniseries. And I am here, I guess I'm like number one Travis Touchdown fan.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I remember, Maddie, I didn't know you were a huge fan of the series until you were staying at my place because you were in town, and we had come back from having dinner, and you made me sit down to watch the new No More Heroes 3 trailer. And I had no idea you were that into the series, but you're like, no, we need to watch it now.
It's one of those things where there's just something about the aesthetic, and there's something about like characters that are like supposed to be really cool, but they're total losers that just pull me in.
And what is your history with the series? Does it go back to the first game? Did you find it late?
Yeah, I'm trying to. Honestly, I don't super remember. I'm pretty sure I got it fairly recent, or like fairly soon after it came out. And I was trying to think, like, how did I even find this, like, you know, stupid, weird Wii game? And honestly, I'm kind of thinking I probably saw it on like X Play or something, because I would have been like just going into high school at the time, and I think I remember just, you know, jokes about how the Wii mode is you have to charge up your beam katana like you're jacking off. And I'm like, I think I was like, wow, this game looks amazing.
Yeah, my
One motion is like did half the marketing for that game, because as silly and as immature as it was, like that's what everyone would kind of talk about, just because the Wii, you know, the Wii had that kid-like toy sort of stature around it, Miasma. And it was like this and Mad World and any games that kind of like did really over the top like stuff like that would actually, you know, like stand out. And I think that stuff wasn't revealed. I just saw that original trailer that was just Travis fighting the one assassin and had a slightly different art style. And I remember seeing that. And all I remembered hearing was that it's from the creator of Killer 7. And while I didn't understand Killer 7 at the time and could barely beat it, I was like, that's all I needed. I was like, oh geez, the Killer 7 guy, I'll play whatever this will turn out to be. And yeah, there's a jacking off motion in the game. And I was like, ooh, bonus.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about that the game in great detail later. But my theory is they thought of the jack off motion first, and then they worked backward to justify it by building an entire game around it. My history with the series was like, like everybody else in America, I found out about Suda 51 by playing Killer 7, and like you, Matt, I could barely finish it, but it was such a unique and original game that was very off-putting to most of the press, but I really loved it, and I was like, what's he going to do next? And it was this game, and it was just a sleepy summer in between the semesters of grad school. I had no job. I was freelancing for 1UP. I think it was like the summer of 08, and I played this over the course of like a weekend, and I just really loved it, and I never thought about it again until just recently, and when there's talk of reviving the series. So yeah, I'm really interested in getting back into it. And I did replay the entire game for this podcast. It's a good 8 hours. It doesn't overstay its welcome. And there might be a Switch version of this by the time you're listening to this podcast, but I'm not sure at this point. We are now in early August. You're hearing this in early October. So you're in the future. We don't know in the future yet. So before we talk about No More Heroes, I want to talk for a bit about Suda 51. I recommend there's a very good video on YouTube that's made by GameSpot. It is essentially him going over his entire career, and it includes lots of visual aids, him drawing on the screen. It doesn't visit everything in great detail, but it shows you like where he was in his life and his different experiences in his career. And it gave me a lot more respect for him. I did respect him before this, but it feels like he's a real underdog in the games industry, even though he owns his own company. Would you, both of you, agree with me on that?
I would say so, but definitely less so than... It's kind of weird. I've been recently replaying some Grasshopper stuff, like Killer is Dead, just a few days ago. And I would say midway to the end of that generation on the 360 and the PS3, like Grasshopper were pumping out some pretty, you know, I wouldn't say AAA games, but like, you know, a B and a half games, like Lollipop Chainsaw, the aforementioned Killer is Dead, and Shadows of the Damned. And I know Shadows of the Damned didn't do well. I mean, commercially, certainly. But I think around that era, and then not too long after that, what's the name? Let It Die, which I was really concerned that was going to, like, torpedo Grasshopper. It just sounds so, like, risky. Like, oh, it's a free-to-play game, but and then thankfully that was a success. So I think around that time period, I was like, Grasshopper really is making some, you know, smart decisions that have paid off, actually. So I'm happy for them in that way, and Let It Die, I think it even still has a player base. But like when No More Heroes was out, and even a few years after that, I would say very, very underdog. And, you know, like I think you are correct in that Suda 51 like owns the company, and he's a little bit more hands off than he used to be. But I think it's weird. I think like their whole like punk band aesthetic, like they're still kind of there, where they still haven't really burst through with like, you know, a multi-million dollar selling game. But I don't think that's what they even really want per se. Like, I don't think they want to have that pressure and, you know, crunch maybe affecting the company. I think they're happy doing their own thing, and it seems like they're continuing to do so.
I was just going to say Suda 51, he's one of those guys that doesn't have as many fans, but he has like the most passionate fans.
Mm.
Yeah,
so that bolsters him up a bit.
I've kind of been hot and cold on him throughout his entire career, where I'd be really into him, but then he would let me down, and then there'd be a game where I really liked, and then he let me down again. So I've been really hot and cold, and now it's running hot for me. Like, I just played a lot of Travis Strikes Back recently. I'm like, no, he still got it. And I mean, I do like the punk rock aesthetic, but you can only be so punk rock when you're like 53 years old and in the industry for 30 years with a family. So in a way, it is like the dad at the club, or the dad at the rock show, you know, in the front row. Like, what's he doing
here? Hello, fellow kids.
Yeah.
I feel there's something about I don't know. You kind of expect that. Like, when it's someone making these kind of off the wall titles, you expect there to be a lot of misses. Like, it'd be weird if they hit every time. You kind of expect them to be kind of janky and not great all the time. But then, like, when you're blown away, you're just like, oh man, this is the greatest ever.
Yeah.
What are some misses for you?
I honestly don't know a lot about his other stuff outside of No More Heroes. I'm just very, very passionate No More Heroes fans, and I haven't really had the chance to explore his other stuff.
Well, what about you, Bob?
I've only played one of his adventure games, and I actually, in the recent Steam sale, I bought Killer 7, both Silver Case games, and Killer is Dead for PC. So I'm going to do a lot of Grasshopper catching up, but I played Flower, Sun, and Rain, the DS port of that, and I just thought it was a really cool style, but just one of the most tedious adventure games I'd ever played in my life, and just wasn't really into it.
I would agree with that, because he was really happy to get that port out there, that Steam port, or Silver Case, I want to say. And those particular two games, I'm kind of like, yep. These are stylish. I'm sure he loves this stuff, but yeah, this is not for me. These games, these pre-Killer 7 titles.
So let's talk about his entire career. So born in 1968, he is one of the handful of Gen X developers from Japan that have a real like enigmatic style all their own, a real auteur style. Like, I consider him in the same league with, not like quality-wise, but in the same sort of personality league as people like Hideo Kojima, Swery, Kazutaka Kodaka. He's a Danganronpa guy. There are so many like Gen X Japanese games creators with like a very, very strong and distinct style, and he is definitely one of them. And for this little history on him, we're only going to go up to 2007, but we'll talk about a few of the things that he did after that, of course. So he has an interesting life in that before he became a game developer, he was working a lot of odd jobs, and he was considering pursuing a career in the mortician industry. Reports on this said he was like, oh, was he an undertaker? Was he a mortician? He was really just involved in like the supply aspect of a, what's the word I'm looking for?
Funeral home.
Funeral home. There you go. He was like in charge of like ordering flowers and arranging them. And he thought like, well, maybe this is what my life is going to be. And he credits his wife a lot in these histories with like, no, my wife is like, do you really want to do this for the rest of your life? Like, his wife saw this creative spark in him that wasn't being fulfilled. He pursued some work at Sega, and his first work there was not even designing games, but actually working on advertisements for the then new Virtual Racing. And before he was able to make the ads, Yu Suzuki, the director of the game, was like, no, I want the designer of the ads to play the game first. And that is the first time he got a look at like what game development is. And he's like, oh, all these guys are my age. They're all like listening to music on headphones. They're all like young, cool guys. I thought they'd be just a bunch of like old professors working at computers, but no, like game development is for me. And that is what gave him the idea, like, I could probably do this.
I never actually heard that bit of his the start of his career before. I didn't even know about the Sega connection at all. Very interesting.
Yeah, he didn't end up working at Sega at all. He just got like an insider look, but he would apply at a bunch of places, one of them being Human Entertainment. And the story went, again, he credits his wife, which is very nice, where he applied, he didn't hear anything, and then his wife was like, you got to call them and find out like if there's an opening. So he calls them, and he finds out the director of Fire Pro Wrestling 3 just left the company, and they needed someone there who knew how to write about wrestling. So he joined that game as a scenario writer. And of course, Fire Pro Wrestling, the series, was basically a Japan-only thing until very, very recently in the States. There was a newer version of Fire Pro here. But before that, it was a very popular and very well-made wrestling series for the Super Famicom. And he essentially made his name with this game, in that the bad ending for the story mode of this game ends with the main character committing suicide. And that is something not done in Super Famicom games at the time. there are videos of this online. It's not like a graphic scene, but if the wrestler you're playing as, you know, loses the final bouts, you see like the text 3 days later, and it's it fades to a shot of the wrestler's house, and you just hear a gunshot. And he said that got him and the company a lot of hate mail. But I guess they respected his spunk at the company because he would go on to direct and write for the next game, which was called Super Fire Pro Wrestling Special. And yeah, that is where he started writing for wrestling games for Human Entertainment.
It's pretty funny because not only is that kind of like, you know, very shocking for a Super Nintendo, Super Famicom game, but, you know, pretty true to life given the wrestling industry. Like, that's something they, you know, don't talk about too often, how the sport of professional wrestling can often lead to early deaths of various causes, suicide being one of them. So when I first heard about that, I was just like, whoa, because I knew of Fire Pro, but I don't think that particular Fire Pro was available in Western parts of the world. So, but I had heard about that pretty early on, like maybe I would say like around No More Heroes' release date. And I was just like, wow, just the balls on this guy. And big ups to Human Entertainment for being like, well, why don't you do some more? Let's see what you can do with it.
Yeah, and then from there, his career, like, No More Heroes is like nothing he made before that. So, like, he went from writing wrestling games to directing these this adventure game series called Twilight Syndrome. These have never even been fan translated. And the director for that left the project, so he was put on to guide it. And these are basically unknown in the States, except if you play Danganronpa 2, one of the cases is based on a Twilight Syndrome game, which is a very weird pull. But that's how I was made aware of this Suda series that, again, not even fan translated. So, yeah, he took over the two Twilight Syndrome games, and then he ended up directing a follow-up to those where he was more involved in the creative process called Moonlight Syndrome, I believe it's called, something like that. And I watch videos of these, and if you've looked at like the Clock Tower game for the Super Famicom, it looks a lot like that. It's like an adventure game viewed from a side perspective, and it's like horror and supernatural elements are part of it. It looks really cool, but no translation at all for these games, so you have to know Japanese to play them. They look neat, though. So yeah, after this, he would go on to leave Human Entertainment. Things were bad for Human. They were, you know, on the verge of going bankrupt. They eventually would. But this is when Suda decided, I want to make my own company. And that's when Grasshopper Manufacture was born in 1998. Grasshopper being named after a, I believe, a song by a British rock band. Like, he is way... Everything he does is either references to British rock or wrestling. That's everything he does, Suda51. And those are two worlds I know nothing about. So yeah, we could talk about Grasshopper stuff. They do a ton of stuff, like you said, Matt. They did like licensed games. They have a lot of output, a lot of different people making games there. I only want to talk about the Suda 51 director games for now. So their first game was called The Silver Case. It's a visual novel style adventure game for PlayStation. Again, this just got a remake in 2016. And in Japan, there was a follow-up for cell phones, and that got a remake in 2018. Those are both on Steam. I do want to push my way through those, but they are not like my style of adventure game, but they are very interesting to look at. And this is where Masafumi Takada would enter the picture, a fantastic musician, and he would collaborate a lot with Suda on his projects. Like, and he is also the composer of the Danganronpa series. Danganronpa does feel very Suda inspired as well, even though he had nothing to do with those games. And then other Suda stuff, 2001 is Flower, Sun, and Rain. This is a PS2 adventure game. That saw a DS port in 2008 by the time everyone knew who Suda was. And like I said earlier, I tried to get into this, but it's a really weird and really tedious and talky adventure game. And all of the puzzles are like kind of like Professor Layton puzzles, except all of the answers are 4-digit codes. And how you find those codes is different every time, but it's just not very fun. I don't know. I forget earlier. Did either of you say you played this one?
No, I was actually thinking of the Silver Case.
Okay.
I've never actually played Flower, Sun, Rain. I was really close to, but then I was like, nah, because I've heard it's really obtuse as well and tedious. So, you chalk that up to like, you know, your favorite creators or creators you admire. And, you know, sometimes they have stuff that they've made that you're just like, you just pass them by. You're like, yeah, no, I respect that they cut their teeth making these things, but yeah, they're not for me. So I'll gravitate towards the things that they make that you know, you do take a passionate like sort of liking to. And No More Heroes is definitely one of those, and a couple other Grasshopper games, but all of his point and click text adventure stuff, I never really dived into them too much.
Yeah, I think the problem is we're missing a lot of the context for these games, and that it's a style of adventure game that we didn't get. And by the time we got these kind of games, they were all Phoenix Wright games, which I think is like the best version of the Japanese adventure game is whatever is ripping off Phoenix Wright is fine. Like, just keep doing that forever. But these are a lot slower. They are a lot less interactive. They're a lot more about atmosphere than actually player action. And you could be into those and that's fine. But that is basically where he came from, is making this kind of adventure game. But 2005 was a big year for Suda. This is when everybody found out who he was, and we were like, well, who is this guy? Where did he come from? And there are all these games he made in the past that never came to America. So yeah, Killer 7, that was his debut in America. It was one of the famous Capcom 5, all intended to be GameCube exclusives. They all left except PN03. I believe is still forever stuck on the GameCube.
Nobody wanted it.
And that game
is okay. Resident Evil 4 has had enough ports to make up for everything else.
That's true. It's been ported to hell and back. And PN03, I wanted to try, but I think it's mainly the game involves just looking at a butt. And there are several games in which you can do that. And the butts are far more accurately rendered these days, anyhow.
I know that there is a small, very small group of people that are like, no, PN09, all the time. And I think for that game specifically, well, obviously we're not going to spend too much time on it because you didn't have anything specifically to do with it. But I just heard people say like, you have to play it. Like it's supposed to be a third person game, but it's like Galaga or Space Invaders or, you know, it's meant to be like that. It's an arcade score attack game, but people thought it was going to be, you know, Devil May Cry or, you know, a third person shooter of that ilk, with like, you know, some sort of melee elements, but it just wasn't appealing to actually play. It's very clunky and stuff, but I'm sure that main character, Vanessa Z. Schneider, will show up in a Capcom versus fighter one day.
She's got to be like one of those strategy games we never get over here.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like this is part of the Capcom 5, Killer 7. These games are all like executive produced by Shinji Mikami, the creator of Resident Evil. And because of that, I honestly feel like Killer 7 is the one game that he made that had like both the time and the money to come into being as intended. And it helped that this game was worked on by Mikami. He is the co-writer of the game and a big producer on it. And I feel like he is a guy who gave Suda a lot of power and kind of pushed him to the level that he is now in the industry. Without Killer 7, I don't think he would be as known as he is today.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that.
And we will be doing an episode on this in the future. I really want to replay it because there is a PC version that is very under-advertised, and it actually makes the gameplay a lot easier because you can play with the mouse. And it's very, very easy that way. And the point of the game is not to be, you know, set against this challenging action. The point is to absorb the story. So I feel like that is the best way to play it. And we'll be talking about that at some point in the future. So after that, a few years pass, and he directs No More Heroes in 2007. And we'll talk about that very soon. But I'll just go over a few other things he's done. Things like, things he directed include Samurai Champloo Sidetracked. And an odd one, something he co-directed, was the Wii-exclusive Fatal Frame game that never came to America that was developed by Grasshopper. Looks really cool, but that was at a time when just so many Wii things were just staying in Japan because the Wii was functionally dead.
Yeah, I've played that. That's like one of the best Fatal Frame games in terms of atmosphere, its scares and stuff. Its controls are not optimal. I believe there was some sort of dispute between Tecmo, I guess, held the rights, but Nintendo also co-published it. The whole Fatal Frame situation, that Nintendo has some type of pull with the series, like they technically or they own a part of it, or Tecmo, and they both companies constantly blame each other. They're like, oh, Nintendo doesn't want to bring this game over to America. And then Nintendo goes, no, it's Tecmo that's the problem. Anyway, that's actually a really, really scary game, and it's just the controls that kind of hold it back a little bit, but it's actually one of my favorite games in the entire series. I really wish it would get a port. I even dug through and found like a translated ROM ISO that like someone had put together, and it was mostly translated. It made it far easier to play, but yeah, really, really underrated game there.
It looked really cool. Yeah, it was one of those late Wii gems. And so yeah, those are the games he's directed, and I believe he's like co-director on Travis Strikes Back. That was his first like seat, at least sharing the director's chair for a long time. But other Grasshopper stuff I wanted to go over, just the highlights. Michigan Report from Hell, unreleased in America, janky as hell, but
I love it.
It's so cool. Like, look up a YouTube of it. Possibly the worst voice acting ever recorded, but an idea that should be revisited. It is a horror-themed Pokemon Snap, and it seems like you have some experience with this, Matt.
Yeah, I've played through it. I've played as much as I can several times. I'll boot it up every so often until I can't take it anymore. It is performance art levels of bad. Like, everything about it is so clunky, but it's so entertaining. It reminds me of that Dreamcast horror game, Illbleed.
Yeah,
things like that. It's yeah, you're right. Some of the worst voice acting you'll ever hear. And it's got a little bit of horror themed Pokemon Snap, which is a pretty good descriptor, but it's also the picture taking mechanic from Dead Rising, where you need to shoot horrific things that are happening, but not help the people. And you can also shoot perverted things, right, that are happening, like upskirt shots. Very, very mid-2000s, very Japanese, that game.
Yeah, I mean, I talked about earlier, like, Killer 7 got the money it needed. This didn't. It's such a cool idea, but it just barely works for what it is. Like, it just... It's such a cool thing, but it just doesn't function as it should. So yeah, Michigan Report from Hell, really cool import game. Shadows of the Dam, something that I hold dear to my heart because it's one of the first games I got to play as a full-time member of the press in 2011. And it's not like very unique or, you know, particularly amazing, but I feel like it is it's a respectable Resident Evil 4-ish game, and I did enjoy like more like Evil Dead take on Resident Evil, like a more horror comedy take on that kind of genre.
Yeah, I plan to make a video about that game specifically because it was supposed to be very, very different. I think there's a quote somewhere where either Shinji Mikami or Suda51 had said, EA just told us, stop it, just make RE4 again.
Yeah, actually, in that video of his career, the GameSpot video, Suda is like, I don't know if I should say this, but if I ever work with EA again, I wish they would just approve things and let us work on them instead of having to reapprove everything over and over again. So
yeah,
that I do want to check out your video. That's probably going to be part of the Wahapa series. Am I correct?
Yeah. It's probably going to be maybe in an October-ish video. Ooh. So, you know, future people, just because it's, you know, relatively spooky themed. But I've heard long that that game was going to be like Lovecraft-esque, and it was supposed to be like really dark and brooding, and it kind of got turned into like this Evil Dead style RE4, which is not bad in of itself, that idea, but you know, it's not the most memorable Grasshopper game by any stretch of the imagination.
And then the following year was Lollipop Chainsaw, a game I want to replay. I reviewed it for 1UP at the time, and it just felt like an undercooked Devil May Cry style game that didn't feel like it was where it needed to be when it came out. Do either of you have any experience with that game, Lollipop Chainsaw?
Do you, Maddie?
Nope.
Yeah, this is another one that I've sunk multiple playthroughs into, trying to unlock all the costumes.
And famously, yeah, James Gunn, did he write the game?
James Gunn apparently translated like a base script and like added his own James Gunn-ish to it. But yeah, like he had to rewrite a lot of dialogue. I remember a quote from him saying like the weird thing about video games, you have to like write the same lines over and over and over again. Like the same zombies have to say different things and you kind of run out of gas. But I think Lollipop Chainsaw, I think its charm, it gets away with its charm. Not all the jokes hit. Gameplay wise, there are definitely some problems. It's something that it was like, from what I remember, it was like the first big Grasshopper success, like a million copies sold plus. And I remember reading, because this is a Warner Brothers published game.
Right, yeah.
And I remember hearing how it was a success. Like, there was an interview, press release, whatever, saying this did really well. And it was always really kind of like, oh, I wish they could have made this a sequel and reiterate on it, polish it. Because the base wackiness and you know, the inherent fun of just killing zombies and stuff in this very pulpy, you know, sort of, what do I say, a grindhouse setting, like, I think was really well done for the most part. And it just needed, you know, maybe another 3 months of just, you know, polishing up animations and maybe like making some levels a little bit shorter. It does kind of go on and on and on, but still a really fun game. It's probably one of, I was disappointed that they didn't, well, I mean, Warner Brothers probably owned the rights to it and wasn't really letting Grasshopper play with it again, because we'll get to that when we talk about Travis Strikes Again.
Yeah, I'd love to see a PC port of Shadows of the Damned and Lollipop Chainsaw, just because Grasshopper's putting out a lot of their old games on the PC and they look better than ever before, including Killer is Dead, a game I haven't played. Everyone trashed it, but I bought it for $6 in the Steam sale in the summer of 2020. I'm like, it's at least worth $6. And Matt, it sounds like you played this one as well, Killer is Dead.
When it was new, I did a full Let's Play of it, but I went back to it with the Steam version that you're talking about, because I did not play the Steam version. The Steam version is called, like, the Nightmare Edition, and it puts all the little bits of DLC, like, they didn't have a DLC campaign, but they had extra levels and missions tacked on. It's weird. It's probably the best combat Grasshopper has ever done, but in terms of its story, it's one of the more like head scratchers. Like, I'm playing this thing and my head is raw and bloody. I'm scratching it so much.
That does sound like Killer 7 story wise at least.
It's weird because Killer 7 makes sense in its own universe, whereas like Killer is Dead barely makes sense. But it's like setting and its characters are more contemporary and easy. It's a very conflicting game, because some things you're like, okay, I know what I'm doing here, and then other times you're like, I don't understand. But gameplay wise, it's quite good. I think the thing that kind of holds it back is because the original Japanese publisher Kadokawa, I think they demanded that the sexy time sections were put in, where your main hero Mondo Zappa has to kind of, I think the way they're called gigolo missions, of course. So you have to kind of talk to women in a bar and you have X-ray glasses, right, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's something that I think Sudo was pretty vocal about, saying, yeah, we didn't want to put these in the game, but they said you need to have some sexy bits. And they're like, okay, here you go. Like, they're harmless when you play them nowadays, but I mean, it doesn't make the game any better, honestly. And there's enough. There's like, you know, women characters on your team, because you're a team of assassins, and there's women characters on their team that, you know, they're fairly sexy, just like any normal hero's female boss or whatever. I think it was fine the way it was, but it is definitely a game worth trying out, because especially the Steam version, art style wise, graphically, it's gorgeous. It's No More Heroes 1 on the Wii, like, but turned up to 11. Just visually, it's worth a playthrough.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I love the art style. And, you know, No More Heroes is a Wii game. It's 480p. But for this podcast, I was looking at a lot of videos of it, of, you know, playthroughs and whatnot. And people have been emulating it in 4K. And if there is a port coming, it's going to look gorgeous, because this art style ages very well when you upscale it.
It does.
And before we move on to No More Heroes, the last game I want to talk about in the Grasshopper Notable Games is Let It Die. I'm only bringing this up because, like, I never play free-to-play games because I have so many other games, and free-to-play games become, like, a part of your lifestyle. Like, you need to check in every day, you need to play it every week, you need to make sure you're actively being part of it or else you're wasting your time and your money. This is the only one of these games where I played it for over 100 hours, and I probably spent like $50 or $60 on it. I think it's like one of the most well-made free-to-play games, although it is grindy as hell, but in a way that I found very soothing.
That was like the first time I met Sudos at PAX East, and that game made its playable debut. And when you're playing it in demo form, I think the whole thing was like survive until the end, survive until the boss, you know, very Dark Souls-ish. And I liked it, but I was like, I'll have to see when it comes out. And I did play it for like a few hours, but it still wasn't really for me, but I still respected it because it had that Grasshopper charm. What's his name? Uncle Skeleton. Is his name Uncle Skeleton?
Uncle Death.
Rich Uncle Skeleton.
I think you're thinking of Rich Uncle Skeleton. No, Uncle Death is a cool, like a rad as hell character, like a skateboarding skeleton with like rad sunglasses.
Yeah, he's my PSN avatar for like the last 4 years or whatever. When the game came out, I was just like, yeah, he's fun. So the game has lots of charm, but like I was still kind of like, yeah, it's not exactly for me. But I'm super glad that was a hit for Grasshopper, because I was like, I mentioned it before, but I was like, this might sink the company if this doesn't do well. Oh my God, I hope it does well.
Happy for them. It seems like it's still doing well because I still follow the Facebook page, and though I haven't played it in 2 years, and there are still updates all the time, like, oh, this event is happening, and oh, log in today to get this. So that thing that's sustaining them for the most part. But yeah, that is a brief history on Grasshopper and Suda51, and when we come back, we'll talk all about the No More Heroes series.
My name is Jonathan Dunn, and I'm inviting you to listen to Our 3 Cents, a weekly podcast where myself and two of my very best gaming chums are counting down our top 100 favourite video games of all time. For all the episodes and information, check out our website, www.our3cents.co.uk.
Ugh, I'm thirsty, but water just won't cut it right now.
Hey, catch!
Whoa, is this a can of cola?
It is, because here at Podford University, our cafeteria has soda. Available on iTunes, Spotify, and everywhere you get podcasts.
Hunter, Hunter, Yu Yu Hakusho, Literary Analysis, Comparative Localization, JoJo References. The works of Yoshihiro Togashi hold a specific kind of magic, and the people who seek to examine their roots and spiritual descendants are known as the Spirit Hunters, available on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
With a purposeful grimace and a terrible smile, join Nikki and Wyatt as we stomp our way through the history of Toho's Daikaiju films in Discuss All Monsters.
Are you telling me we're going to discuss all monsters?
We won't stop until there isn't a monster left to discuss. Smash that play button like Godzilla and King Kong smash an 18th century Japanese pagoda.
Only on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
So we are back to talk about No More Heroes, starting with the first game, of course. And I want to talk a bit about the development of the game. Unfortunately, there is not a lot online because I don't think people really cared too much about Suda at the time to want to talk to him. And there's only like two or three interviews that I could dig up. Oh, sorry, Matt.
I don't care about you.
Well, I mean,
I don't want to talk to you.
I feel like all of the interviews that happened were just like, I've had these interviews before in the press. Like, talk to that guy. It's like, oh, what'd he do? He's making this game. Go talk to him. And that's like, you don't know who he is. You don't know the context for it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of these interviews were just like, how many levels will the game have? Like, there was no real deep insight into like, no, you're talking to Suda 51. Talk about movies and music and wrestling and stuff. Like, it was just like your beat reporter in the games press being shoved into a room with Suda to talk about this game. They had no idea what it was, but what I could find out is that it was working, it was running under the working title of Project Heroes. It was going to be a 360 game, and the producer on it, Yasuhiro Wada, who's also the creator of Harvest Moon, he suggested that's like, let's make this a Wii game. The Wii's kind of cool. And even Suda was like, well, yeah, the Wii is not out yet, but it's going to be more of a family oriented system, and this could be like a mature game for it to show that's like, oh, that audience will want something as well, something to play as well. But yeah, that was the kind of narrative at the time, that the Wii was the baby system. I have a ton of affection for the Wii, and there's a ton of like great hardcore games for it, but in the press it was not taken seriously at all.
Yeah, like I feel very much the same way. Like, I look back on the Wii very, very fondly. Yes, there's tons of family fodder, but there's lots of gems in there that like wouldn't have been possible like without the Wii being what it was. And No More Heroes, when that was like, I mentioned that like really early trailer when it was called Project Heroes. I've always heard this, but I don't know about like how true it is. But the only reason it changed names was because they ran into like, you know, problematic issues trying to get that name, because Heroes, the NBC show, was like at the time, like still going on. But then when I actually tried to look that up, I couldn't really find anything. There's like one article that stated as a rumor on like IGN Insider board. So I didn't really trust it.
That could be more reputable, I guess. But the title of the game does rip something else off, like everything he does. It is the title of a song by the Stranglers called No More Heroes. You're going to hear it in this podcast. It's a band I've never heard of. It's a song I've never heard of, but Suda loves British rock so much. And there was a one-up panel with him, or sorry, a one-up post-panel interview with him at some GDC after the game came out. And he talked about like everything that influenced the game. And this is where all the information comes from, this panel he did after the game came out. So a big inspiration for this game was El Topo. Just the idea of like an assassin battle, like somebody has to take out a number of assassins. In the movie, it's like 3 or 4. In the game, it's 10. And I think like, it's seemingly all of his games involve assassins in some way.
Yeah, I think there's he like, you know, the Cornetto trilogy, you know, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. Like Suda has a name for this, like anything that involves assassins, swords, whatever. He calls it something, but I always forget what exactly.
Yeah, he said this is a part of a trilogy with two other games. I think maybe Samurai Champloo and Blood, like their video game version of Blood, the anime series, where it's just like they all use swords. And
yeah.
It's like an evolution of playing with a sword in a video game.
It's something like that. I think even Killer is Dead was like added later, or, you know, he threw that around because that was another game he did not direct, but I mean, produced or, you know, oversaw it or whatever. But yeah, like in general, when it was No More Heroes was, well, No More Heroes, I forget when that name actually they started using it, but I was just like, oh, okay, cool, it's called No More Heroes now. And then when I was working at my job doing QA, like everyone's lazily sitting around in a meeting, they're like, oh, okay, I was a team lead at this time, they're like, okay, so we have another game called what is it, and a guy like looks at a piece of paper and goes, No More Heroes for the Wii, and everyone else groans. And I raise my hand and go, I'll take it, I'll give it to me. And yeah, I found myself like working with Ubisoft, and Ubisoft really, really didn't. Well, the main producer kind of like cared, but he was saying like his boss is like, nobody at Ubisoft wanted to test it. They have like a huge QA department. They were like, no. just give it to somebody else. And we're based in Montreal as well as with Ubisoft. And I was clicking my heels, just pinching myself, going, oh my God, I get to test Nova Heroes.
Yeah, at the time, yeah, Ubisoft was not quite like, when this game released, Assassin's Creed 1 had come out, and it was not quite the, you know, people thought it was cool, but 2 is the one that put the series on the map, and 2 is the reason why we still have games today. Like, people were kind of iffy on 1, so it felt like Ubisoft was trying a lot of different things, including getting in bed with Grasshopper and doing Japanese-style games.
They published a bunch of Naruto games.
Oh, that's right. Damn.
That's so weird. Like, you compare just like 10 years ago to now. They put out a Hooters game.
I kind of miss that era of Ubisoft where it's like they weren't just making 3 versions of the same game every year. It was just like, just try everything. You have lots of money.
Well, thankfully, that guy that does that at Ubisoft is like, you know, got kicked out of the company. So that's
true. That might change their culture in more ways than one. We'll see. Other things that inspired the game include Jackass, the movie, and presumably the TV series. Like, when I was sitting down to play the game, I'm like, just, you know, making notes in my head. I'm like, Travis Touchdown, obviously. He's a bit of Johnny Knoxville, a bit of, you know, Brad Pitt from Fight Club. And then I was reading about this, it's like, no, he is just Johnny Knoxville. Like, Suda51 loves Jackass, and when pitching this game to his team, like, he is showing them clips of Jackass and his team is not laughing. They're like, what, why are you showing this, why do you think it's funny? But like, this essentially is coming as close to just stealing Johnny Knoxville as he can without being sued. Like, this is the Johnny Knoxville Jackass game. And I have no, full disclosure, I don't like Jackass. And...
yeah, no, that's funny because I'm the exact same way. I can't stand it, but I love Travis Touchdown, so I don't know.
I mean, like, maybe Matt can...
I think it must be the like the otaku part that they shoved into him that just made him so much more special.
Yeah, like,
I think... Travis has a lot of things in him, and I think all those things, like, if he was just Jackass, then I don't think he would have all that much appeal or very limited appeal. But because you put otaku stuff, because you put wrestling, that's what makes him like a character that is very appealing at the end of the day.
Yeah, like, I have kind of a grudge against Jackass because it turned all of my indoor friend my indoor kid friends into outdoor teens who wanted to, like, hurt themselves. And I was like, I just want to play Mario Kart, guys. And they were all like, no, let's break this TV and get shards of glass in our legs. And I was not on board with that, and I blame Johnny Knoxville, but I've gotten over it. But yeah, this is Travis Touchdown, Johnny Knoxville to a T. And he still is all these years later. And a funny thing about this game is, like, obviously there are Star Wars references in the game because you have a fucking lightsaber. You're swinging it around. It makes the same noises. But Suda is very, very cagey about this. And in the video on GameSpot, he's just like, well, you know, just to be safe, we're going to say it's from Spaceballs, not Star Wars. Actually, he doesn't even say Star Wars. It's like, oh, it's a reference to Spaceballs or this Japanese series called Space Sheriff Gavan. But I'm thinking, like, it's plausible that this could be a Spaceballs reference because in Spaceballs, the light swords were a metaphor for your penis, and it's very much the same thing in No More Heroes.
You know, beam katana is legally distinct, which is the best type of distinct.
I was going to say it's also like a million times cooler.
It is, yeah. These are way cooler than lightsabers. You can just buy them online, I guess, according to the game story.
As an aside, while testing the game, like, they just straight up had slightly blurred posters of Revenge of the Sith in the video store.
Oh, wow.
Like they're different now in the final game, but we were like, don't, like, you write a bug and they're like, legal issue, do not show Star Wars things.
Oh, I'm sure George Lucas isn't litigious, right?
I've never heard of such a thing, but
he's got a sense, like, of humor.
I think there's an enemy that appears later on in the game that's just basically a dark trooper, a TIE fighter pilot, rather. And we were like, like, we made a bug, like, maybe change just the helmet, just a different color or something. And they never did. Thankfully, nothing came of it. But there were a lot of more overt Star Wars references in background textures and stuff that they smartly changed.
Wow, I had no idea. That's I guess they were skirting closer to possible lawsuits in an earlier version of the game.
Yeah.
And the location of the game in this panel that Suda did, he said it was based on Dirty Harry. But Dirty Harry took place and was filmed in San Francisco. And then he said, we went to San Diego for research. And San Diego is a very, very different looking town than San Francisco. As someone who lives near San Francisco, I can tell you that. And this town, Santa Destroy, the town of the game, is such a Southern Californian flat town. It is not San Francisco at all.
Yeah, I don't know. I could get like a San Jose vibe from it, maybe, like that part of Northern California.
It could be. But yeah, it's definitely not San Francisco, though.
No, it's not San Francisco.
No, like there's no hills. There's like one hilly area in Santa Destroy, and it's not even that hilly. So,
but yeah, it is very, like, to me, it is a very flat Southern California town.
Yeah,
you can just feel like the heat.
Big roads and palm trees and buildings and like no grass.
And broken dreams.
The sidewalks are scattered with them. But yeah, Matt, you were talking about earlier, there was an earlier trailer that was more violent. And in some early interviews, it seemed that this game was going to be a much more violent, less cartoonish game. And Suda was even saying pre-release, like, I want this game to be as violent as Hitman 2. And I guess in a way it is, because you're seeing like a head get chopped off every 3 seconds. But to me, like, weirdly enough, it doesn't feel like a violent game, because when you cut a head off, coins fly out of the neck stump along with blood.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, how could you make it more violent? Is it just make it more realistic looking?
I guess more like grisly and more realistic.
Because there's lots of just like spurting blood, but like you said, it's cartoony and it's stylized, so it's just kind of like, oh.
The cell shading also, like, just in general makes things look less realistic that way as well.
Yeah, I guess this was censored in Japan, though, because they are a little more touchy about violence in the past, like, 20 years. And the blood is now just, like, black clouds. But in America, we have the full geysers.
Yeah,
in our version.
I think in Europe too it also had the black clouds in Europe. And I remember at the time, reading, because I'm gonna admit it, I was on the IGN insider forums. I paid for that
in 2002. Sorry, Matt.
No problem. I remember Europeans being really pissed, like Australians as well, just like, oh god, we get this, why, like. And I think there was like a big hullabaloo about that, even with the later 360 and PS3 versions. There's a 360 version I've never played, because I don't think it ever actually came out in the West. I think it was Japan.
Yeah, that was Japan.
That's
it
so
was,
weird.
Yeah.
The Japanese version of the 360 game is Japan only.
That is bizarre. That came up in my notes, and I was like, how was there an original 360 game in Japan? I don't understand that.
I wanted to also bring up the character designer for this game.
Oh, please do.
Yeah, Yusuke Kozaki, his like main job is as a manga artist, but he's like, none of his titles are known over here. But he's been the character designer on all four of the No More Heroes games. And I think one of the reasons these games are so cool is that the character designs are really incredible. And his first credit as a character designer was on Ostatake Oendan, which is the Japanese cheerleader dancing game on the DS that... like they made Elite Beat Agents over in the US. That was kind of like the spiritual sequel to it.
Yeah, I forgot that designer worked. I can definitely see similarities in just the very strong and striking character design between both games.
Yeah. And that game is super stylized and has those really like these like straight bold lines. And then, and then he brought all his just these really cool designs to all four of the No More Hero games. And he's also done stuff, Fire Emblem, Awakening, and Fates. And he also did the designs for Pokemon Go. So he has kind of like a varied career. But if you look at all those things, you can see, you know, kind of his style and these kind of cool, spiky characters that he creates.
Yeah, he's got to design a lot of unique characters for these games, because they're all designed around fighting a bunch of cool looking bosses. But yeah, let's talk about No More Heroes, the game released in December of 2007 in Japan and just a month later in the US in January of 2008. So available for the Wii, and in the States there was a PS3 version that was Move compatible. Hey, remember Move? I kind of do. And I reviewed this for 1UP, and when I sat down to play it, I'm like, you know what? I like the Wii game. It ran at about 24 frames per second on a good day, so it's going to be fun to see this with the power of the PS3, and you know what? I kind of think it ran worse. Those are my memories of the game. And Matt, I think you have experience with this one, the PS3 port of No More Heroes.
Yeah, it absolutely runs worse, and maybe not in all areas, but it's very consistent with the Wii performance. And I think in some areas it's like worse in general. That being said, I was always like really dismissive of the port before I played it because, you know, it's like 2008, 2009, whenever it came out. So I was like, the Wii's the best. Meh, shut up, PS3. Nobody likes you, you know. So as you do. But it was mostly because Suda was really, really dismissive of the port because it was not done by Grasshopper. It was done by, I want to say, Feel Plus, makers of Bullet Witch. And I was kind of like, oh, this isn't like the director's vision. And at that time, I was really on board the Suda train where I was like, no, he's an auteur. He knows what he wants. And he doesn't, you know, and it was really weird that Konami somehow were the ones that published this port. Like, how does that happen? Like,
yeah, I guess
Hadakawa Marvelous had the rights in Japan, then Ubisoft had it in North America, but then Konami got it for some reason.
Yeah, it was a year after the sequel, the Wii sequel, this came out in 2011.
Right,
so maybe
right.
Ubisoft was like, we don't want No More Heroes anymore. You can put this port out yourself or find somebody else to do it.
There's something else that's weird about the port is that they also added a Japanese dub to it.
Okay.
Because Travis has always like been in English, and he's voiced his English voice is really good, and it's very true to his character. He's voiced by a British actor, actually, which is weird, but his name is Robert Atkin Downs, and he does like this really good job. And but then in the Japanese dub, he's voiced by Kazuya Nakai, who's the voice of Zoro in One Piece.
Whoa.
And it's like it's really bizarre. Like it doesn't fit him at all. And I don't know why they decided to do a Japanese dub of it.
I mean, I guess that's star power, but not a fitting voice at all for Travis Touchdown.
It's super weird. It's weird hearing Zoro say Moe.
I need a clip
like
of that.
He's got a really deep voice, doesn't he?
Yeah, and it just doesn't work for a loser nerd. It's just, yeah. It's so strange.
But because this game came out in the first like 18 months of that console, the Wii, it uses like all of the Wii stuff, but I'm actually surprised by how reserved it is, where you could have easily made this into a Twilight Princess style experience where you're just like swinging the Wiimote back and forth to do the sword swings. But no, you attack with the A and B buttons, and then the swings of the Wiimote are done very selectively when you're doing the finishing moves on the enemies, and it does feel very satisfying. So you wear down an enemy's health, and then like a little prompt will appear on the screen, and that's when you move the controller in a certain direction to lop off their head or cut them in half or so on. So
it's still brilliantly designed the way that they, especially early on in the Wii's life cycle, to make that smart decision, like, because a lot of companies did not.
Yeah, I definitely remember I introduced it to one of my friends and she like kept trying to swing it like to use the sword. I'm like, no, you don't do that, just be patient, you do it when you do the wrestling moves.
Yeah, I think like every game developer thought of a sword when they first saw the Wiimote, but then they realized like, oh, this can't really work the way we want it to. And only until the Wiimote Plus came out could you actually have your one-to-one sword game, and that was Skyward Sword. Like, it wasn't happening for the Wii in the first 4 or 5 years. And also, like, it made me remember all the things the Wiimote could do, and it has what I call Flintstone phone technology, in which, yabba-dabba-doo, Sylvia's talking to you. Before every boss fight, you get a little call on your Wiimote.
This is, like, one of my favorite things about this game. I remember, like, my first time playing it, and, like, the Wii remote starts, like, ringing and vibrating, and I'm like, what? And you, like, lift it up to your ear, and you're like, hello?
it's so cheesy, and like only, I mean, I'm sure more games support it, but I can think of like two or three others that use this. It's like Zack and Wiki, Silent Hill Shattered Memories, and Fragile Dreams, and a few other ones, but like it's such a cheesy trick, but I do like it, playing with a controller like that. And then I remember like, oh yeah, my PS4 controller could do this too, but absolutely nobody is making any games that do this for the PS4.
No.
Complete waste of technology.
I do.
It's weird because I'm not sure if he designed that because the Wiimote could do that, or that was always going to be in the game. Those long conversations with Sylvia before a boss fight, where like that's the only time someone really calls you on the phone, other than when like you're in a static cutscene. And that's a fact I've never seen Suda specifically talk about. Maybe it's in there in an interview somewhere, but like you said, most interviews were like, what do you do in No More Heroes?
Travis touchdown,
I do. I was going to say that I do love how it breaks up the gameplay, though. So whether it was, you know, there from the start or not, because it's like you fight your way through all the assassins, and then you have this like really calm moment where you're just like talking on your Wiimote phone before you go into the final battle. So I think it kind of creates this really smooth gameplay.
It does feel a bit like in Killer 7, before you fight the boss, you're in this area with no combat and like the coolest music ever. So it feels like a similar, like an echo of that, like a nice, like a little rest before a big boss fight that lets you chill out a bit. The plot, I do like the plot of all these games because they make a big joke about how like you are dumb to care about the plot, and the characters are aware they're in a game, and the games are kind of written like a wrestling or soap opera stories, and that everybody's got like an evil twin or like a secret sister or like all of these weird plot twists that are not, you know, earned at all. But the plot is summed up in the beginning very quickly in what feels like in any other game it would be a longer cutscene or an interactive sequence, and like Travis is essentially suckered into entering this assassin's contest by killing someone for money, unaware that when he kills this person, he is killing the 11th ranked assassin, and now he's part of that list and he's got to work his way up to the top. And essentially he's doing it all because he's extremely horny for the woman who is suckering him into doing all of this and this just giant extortion scheme that he is gladly taking part in. So, like, with every new assassin, you have to buy your way into the contest, and you're paying off this woman named Sylvia, who is promising Travis sexual favors that never come, ultimately.
In this game.
In this game, right. I didn't play a lot of two. So maybe it pays off for Travis in the end. But I mean, like, now we have the words for this I didn't have in 2007. Travis is, I think the kids would call him a fuckboy, and he's quote unquote simping. Is that, am I correct?
Yeah, that sounds right.
I'm learning. I'm keeping up with the slang. But yeah, so Sylvia is essentially tricking Travis into this just giant extortion scheme and doing all of her bidding. And there's no like coherent plot or whatever. Don't expect one. In fact, when you fight the last boss, she's like, well, I have this bombshell to drop, but if I told you this information, the game will get a higher rating. So they fast forward past her important exposition. And then when it cuts back to the action, Travis is like dumbstruck, like, oh my God, I can't believe it. So like, they withhold information for anyone who actually cares about the plot.
If you do like record and you can slow down what she says and it's actual written dialogue, that's actually quite messed up.
Yeah, I'm glad they fast forwarded past that. There's a video you can just watch online that's like the slowed down version of it. So I did watch it, like, what is she saying? But yeah, there's a reason why Travis is reacting the way he is during all of that. But yeah, how the game plays is the main point of the game is you fight in these 10 ranked battles, and they amount to a small level before a unique boss fight at the end. And again, you have to pay your way into every battle you do. In order to do this, you have to either do these like weird like community service style mini games on the map, or
like collecting coconuts and mowing lawns,
like killing scorpions, cleaning up graffiti, pumping gas, things like that,
playing with cats.
That would pay off in the second game.
This is like one of the few games where you can pet cats, and you can pet cats a lot, and that's like one of the greatest qualities of it.
They really,
it's like one of the earliest games that did that too.
Even now, it's usually like, oh, you can pet the dog in this game, but I'm like, what about the cats? And this one, right? You like Travis has this cat named Gene, and it's like between every mission, like Gene's always doing something different in his apartment, and you can like always interact with her, and it's just a blessing.
The best one is when she's attached to like the little chew toy that's attached to Travis's overhead fan.
Ceiling fan.
Meow.
Yeah,
amazing.
The second game would amp up the cat petting to become like a make your cat lose weight mini game, which is kind of fun. I did like that.
Okay.
But yeah, like, so it takes place in this open world called Santa Destroy. And I remember, like, the games press was getting a lot more thinky around this time. Like, BioShock came out, and people were like, wow, this game is so smart. And I think every game has something to say. And I think a lot of people at the time were thinking, oh, this game is a commentary on open world games. That's why the quests are these mundane tasks. And that's why the open world is so empty. And my own theory is just like, well, no, this is the best open world game they could make with their budget and the platform. And I think Suda just likes the comedy of this guy is lopping off heads and fighting these superpowered assassins, but also he is pumping gas and killing scorpions and picking up garbage. Like, he likes that comedy juxtaposition between those two activities.
Digging t-shirts out of dumpsters and...
dumpsters, yeah.
You should never think too hard about what he does. He just puts in things that he thinks are cool, and that's about it.
Like, bollocks to the people that are like, oh, this is a commentary on open. Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. It's like, this is the best they could have done. That being said, weirdly, because I spent like, I don't know, 500 hours playing through the open world because of my job at the time, I, you know, had a night shift and I'm playing through the game and I'm looking for bugs in the open world because that's where you're going to find the most. Just because of the physics, driving with your Akira motorcycle bike. And I was like, oh, there's got to be something here. And like, surprisingly, like, there wasn't that many issues. Like, you could drive through like a building in a certain angle. It was really, really hard to do. But I actually really like the open world. And it's because I don't know, like, I guess it's the Stockholm Syndrome thing. I was just stuck in that open world for so long. I like collecting the dodge balls that you redeem for new moves. And I like getting all the t-shirts in the dumpsters. There's something kind of soothing about that open world. But like, if someone says, man, I hate that open world, like, what am I supposed to say to you? No, it's amazing. It absolutely isn't. But
yeah,
when they changed that up for the sequel, I'm sure we'll talk about it a bit later, I was kind of let down. But at the same time, I was like, well, no, I'm not going to tell you, no, the open world needs to be part of the No More Heroes experience. But because we're not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure Suda did confirm it, No More Heroes 3 will have the open world back. I'm like, yes.
Like, yeah, I mean, I just love, and I love how like janky the motorcycle driving is, because it's like you want to like go be cool and drive around your motorcycle, but then you just like crash instantly and like fly off.
Definitely you can. You can get good at it, though. I'm not sure if the game ever actually tells you, but if you swing the Wii remote and press brake, you do like a hairpin turn, and you can get good at it. But I don't think the game actually tells you you can do that.
I don't think it tells you at all.
Most people put the effort into getting good at it.
Yeah, I mean, this came out like right before GTA 4, but GTA was huge. I mean, it's huge now, but like all the things you'd expect in an open world game are not here. Like the NPCs don't have dialogue. There aren't that many funny signs. There's no radio. There aren't too many things to find in the open world. I'm kind of with you, Matt. I mean, I didn't test the game, but I found it kind of like a soothing experience, sort of like I had just came off of playing Deadly Premonition, and it's more dense than that game world, but I kind of just like tooling around in it, just kind of soothing. And you know, there's no enemies to fight, no one's after you, just like I'll just drive around in this world at 20 frames per second.
Yeah, I mean, again, like what I said with like the cell phone part, it's like the main part of the game is like you're fighting, you know, 30 guys at once, and it's just hack and slash and coins and blood flying everywhere. So I think to have these very quiet moments in between that is actually quite nice.
It is. And like when you complete the game once, you have that new cards and collectibles get spawned in the open world when you do New Game Plus, and you need your radar upgrade to find them. They're buried in various pieces of grass. And I remember thinking that was so cool. It's like, oh, wow, you get to go through the open world again. But now there's collectibles that are like, I think it's the trading cards. There's like 150, something like a crazy high number of trading cards that gives you additional information on the bosses.
Yeah, yeah. And there's like a metal detector kind of game where it's like you can walk around and feel a little rumble, and then you can dig with your katana.
That's what it is.
Katana.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was so cool when I realized that. Because we received very little documentation on the game. Again, it was Ubisoft that needed to provide information in English for us to test. and our bugs were getting sent to Grasshopper, but we needed someone that could speak and translate English to Japanese. So we actually had a Japanese tester there on site with us that every time we might write a bug in English, you would translate it. And so Grasshopper could fix it. And we received a lot of, I would say, incomplete information about the game. I'm sure to talk about it in a second, just because I'm on this train of thought now. When you're killing people in No More Heroes and you're lopping people's heads off, there's a slot machine that runs on the bottom of the screen. And most times nothing happens. But if you get the right collection of symbols, you get a special power, like strawberry on the shortcake, whatever silly thing Travis says, and you get a special power for, like, you know, 15 seconds. If you get triple sevens, you get an ultimate move called Anarchy in the Galaxy that wipes out all enemies in the room that you're in. During the entirety of testing, we had no idea this move was in the game. Because it's a specific button combo. Unlike all the special moves you get, I'm sure you guys probably know this, but unlike when you ever get the slot machine to give you a special move, it instantly activates. And you just get it. It's like Travis throwing fireballs, or he goes like Super Saiyan Travis Super Saiyan, and his hair becomes gold, and he can kill everybody really, really easily. This one move, Anarchy in the Galaxy, you need to trigger by holding like B and press A at the same time while holding like minus or something. I forget what it is. We had no idea that move was in the game. So that could have broken the game. That could have crashed it. We had no clue because Ubisoft didn't know.
And does that move still exist in the game?
Yeah, it's okay. In there. It's just that it's so rare because you need to roll a 777. And once you get that 777, it's like a move that's stocked on your screen, and you have to activate it. Hmm. We had no idea it was in there the entire game. So when I actually got my own copy of the game and it says that in the instruction booklet, didn't say anywhere in the localization or any of the files that we got. So I was like, what? There's like some screen clearing move. And I did it and I fell off my chair. I was like, oh my God, this could have like wiped your Wii hard drive, or not hard drive, but wiped all your Wii memory or your game saves. We never would have known.
I need to find a video of this now, I think.
I think it's a move that happens more regularly in No More Heroes 2, I think. Anarchy in the Galaxy, it's called. But like, in the first game, it's very, very rare. Like in an entire playthrough, you might get it once. And even then, you need to read the instruction booklet. It tells you nowhere in game that this move is even available. That's amazing. That's punk.
That's the ultimate punk rock. Risking breaking your Wii for one powerful move. let's talk a bit more about the combat. So you mentioned there's this little slot machine that pops whenever you kill an enemy, and they can give you various powers. But
yeah, I wanted to expand on that too.
Oh, go for it.
Like you said, he says all these weird stuff. He says like strawberry and the shortcake, or he'll say blueberry cheese brownie, or things like that. And you're like, what? And it's all because like in the world, there's this like anime that Travis loves called Pure White Lover Bizarre Jelly, and it's what he wears on his main shirt, and he has like the poster of it in his room. It's about these like magical girls that turn into mechas. So whenever he's like yelling this nonsense, it's just him referencing like his favorite anime.
Oh, I didn't know that. And you can also, Maddie, you can also play the retro game version of that like on his TV, right? Is that based on the anime that he likes?
Yeah. And then it also has the theme song is like related to it as well. It's a really cool song that plays through the game sometimes called Heavenly Star by Genki Rockets.
Yeah.
And it plays sometimes during his special attack modes. And it's like a really fantastic, just like kind of J-poppy song.
But yeah, more about the combat system. We talked a bit about it earlier, but it's very, very simple. It's very straightforward. It's just as complex as it needs to be. And I think it involves just as much waggle as is tolerable. And it's very easy. Like I found the combat not too difficult and very satisfying to do those finishing moves, and especially if like lots of enemies are around you and you do one, you can just fill the screen with like gushing geysers of blood that will send your frame rate skyrocketing downward to like single digits, but it's still very cool. And also this involves wrestling moves as well. Like Travis can learn a bunch of wrestling moves that aren't quite as effective as the beam katana moves, but they're still very cool and take a bit more work with your waggle to pull off.
Yeah, they look cool and they feel really satisfying because you get like these prompts for like a directions to tilt your Wiimote and nunchuck, and then when you do it, it activates and you're like, ah, that was great.
They almost never work. The first time you do the motion, they almost never work, but it's so lenient. It gives you like 6 seconds to like do the motion again, and you'll never not get them, but sometimes it just takes a few times. It's something that they cleaned up in No More Heroes 2. Like, I don't think it ever, I think at the end of the day, they're like, fuck it, any motion, it doesn't matter. You follow the screen, you don't follow the screen, do whatever you want, the move will trigger.
Yeah, you deserve it. This isn't a game about being like super challenging and being this really difficult. It's about a game that's really satisfying to go around and slice up a bunch of people and do some, you know, pile drivers on them.
It's not that difficult. Difficulty comes in with the bosses, in that these range in difficulty from like, you know, passable to very annoying, but I got through the game okay on the regular difficulty, and all these bosses feel like a riff on Metal Gear, in that they're all these like very enigmatic, cartoonish bosses, all with their own unique gimmicks and backstories and life philosophies. You hear all of them up front before the battle, and they all have really cool goofy pseudonames like Dr. Peace and Speed Buster and Destroy Man. Like, he is
Harvey Mosewicz Fordolarski. The little like electric voice that says the name of each assassin when you enter the level is like one of my favorite things in the world.
And I think that comes up in other
entire time on the internet where people would use that every so often, like anyone that knew No More Heroes. I kind of found like
there's like a Chuck E. Cheese one I think someone did not that long ago. Like Charles Entertainment Cheese, and it's like the ding, and it has like the silhouette. It was so good.
Yeah, I love that voice.
Cool. It's a voice that's used in Killer 7 as well. It's not the exact same pitch, but you can tell it's really, really close. It's like it's whenever the character in Killer 7 called Travis speaks to you, the little ghost guy that always wears a funny T-shirt. Which I find is a neat connection. But whenever he talks to you in Killer 7, he has almost the exact same voice as those little boss announcements.
Yeah, he did carry the robot voice over from that. It's a bit different, but it's definitely the same kind of effect too. And the bosses are a lot of fun. I feel like the combat system does not work too well against them, because often, they're fun to fight, they're fun to look at, their arenas are neat, but ultimately a lot of these boss fights boil down to waiting for your small window in which you can attack and then attacking, and that small window almost always comes like right after they launch a big attack on you.
You're super not wrong at all. That being said, the boss fight against Shinobu Jacobs is like absolutely one of my favorite boss fights like in all of video games, because the lead up to it, the cutscene leading up to it, the music, how cool Shinobu Jacobs, and you play that fight on Bitter, like you can't mess up. Bitter is the hardest difficulty mode in the game for anyone that hasn't played. You play that on Bitter, and because of testing, you do need to assign people to play the games on different difficulties to make sure that there's, you know, nothing like egregious, or, you know, the game doesn't crash, blah, blah, blah. But fighting Shinobu on that stage with that music, and she's super, super tough. And not every boss has this. I'm pretty sure not every boss, but certain bosses have an ultimate attack that can almost always kill you, unless maybe you're at full health. Maybe you can survive it and you've leveled up your health to the max that you can up to that point. Shinobu has like a super cool, like ultimate killing move that can wipe you out in like one shot. And you have to be on, like some of the boss fights later after her are not as demanding as her fight is, but it's actually like I said, like one of my favorites of video gamedom in general. I love that fight.
Yeah, I do like it too. I like the arena. And you're right, there are some weird difficulty spikes. Like, I was having a good time with this game, and I was like, you know what? I'm pretty good at No More Heroes. And then I got to the Holly Summers fight. That's a boss that takes place on a beach. and there are all these holes that she's dug. If you fall in the hole, you have to wag your controller, and she's always constantly firing homing missiles at you. And yeah. I think I had to fight that boss like 6 or 7 times and watch a video to be like, what am I getting wrong? And I think it's one of those boss fights where the lack of an analog stick, a second analog stick rather, is kind of what fails the game sometimes, because you don't have that precise camera control that you need to see everything you need to see. So it's often a lot of guesswork, like, oh God, is a missile about to hit me, or is something coming at me I can't see? Like hitting the cross pad is not as effective as moving a right analog stick around.
It's not. And that boss fight in general, there's a good percentage of just luck based on how you're, like, if you know the map really well, you can kind of avoid the holes in on the floor, but like in the sand rather. But yeah, it's one of the more, like, you can you know, like, as a speedrunner would say, am I going to get a good Holly fight today, or am I going to get a bad one? Is she just going to decide to be mean to me? It's Holly Summers, very cool boss, but yeah, not one of the more frustrating fights in the game.
It makes me feel better to know that speedrunners hate her too. It's not just me. I mean, so we went over all the main points. We can go over all, like, the minor stuff. Like, one thing I forgot to mention, it came up a little bit, but like, Travis is a man who enjoys a good t-shirt, and I'm there with him. I love graphic tees, and a lot of this game is optionally, of course, you can dress him up any way you want to with a number of different t-shirts. And in the newest version of the game, you can actually wear t-shirts based on like existing indie games. But I love that aspect of the game, the dress-up element. His main clothes can't change too much, but you can just go wild with all these cool and lewd t-shirt designs that he has.
And I think the first game has the best selection of shirts. The second one, they're good, but there's not nearly as many because there's no open world, so you don't particularly collect them. They're just in a store waiting to be bought, which I was kind of like, but yeah, the first game style factor for shirts is certainly better. But
shirts and jackets too.
That's like true. That's
different
true.
Jackets. It's yeah. It's like character customization is always a plus for me in any game, and so if there's something like collect all these shirts and all these jackets, then I'm like, yes, I will do that.
And one thing I really wanted to mention too is that these games, what I like about them as a guy who likes retro games, obviously, is like so much of this game, like the iconography is steeped in just the language of retro video games. Like your health power-up is a giant floating pixel pizza slice. There are like old school video, like high score lists and sound effects, like so much of it. Yeah.
We didn't even mention the save points.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Please, Maddie.
He saved by going to the bathroom.
Exactly. And it's clearly number two. The pants are coming down and you're sitting
down.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
But it does retain the fun censorship of unrolling the toilet paper in front of his crotch as he goes to pull his pants down. In every game, it's the same.
It's perfect. It's yeah, I don't know. It's just like one of those little things that just adds so much to it.
You're very right, and the fact that each boss has a unique bathroom that you could go into right before the boss fight, like it's always like in some type of porta potty or like in a mall or whatever it is, it's always like this uniquely modeled bathroom that's made for that boss.
Yeah, I thought about that upon this replay. I'm like, somebody had to sit down and model this porta potty and put
well,
the graffiti
and also
on
too,
it.
Like Sylvia's always like, oh, make sure you go to the bathroom before you fight him.
It's very important, both in the game and in real life. But anything else with No More Heroes 1? I do want to move on to talk about the other two games in the series that exist currently. But anything I'm missing about this game?
The only other thing I was going to mention, like, to, you know, I keep kind of coming back to this whole idea about, like, the slow parts between the battles. And, like, one thing is between every assassin, you know, you return to your apartment. And then you can kind of do your part-time jobs or whatever you feel like doing. But you always get a phone call from Sylvie about your next assassin. But
right.
Before that, you always have a voicemail from like the like adult video store that's yeah. like telling Travis like, oh, you know, your how to have sex 101 video is late. Please return it. And like then there's also this one where it's like, you gave us this video, but it was just this man like humping a body pillow. Why did you it's like it just like God, he's such a loser. And
yeah.
I think that's why he's so charming, because he's like supposed to be really cool, but he's not at all.
I do like that that dichotomy, because, like, again, in the overly thinky discussion about this game, people were like, oh, is Travis a parody of the gamer? And no, that's not true. Like, again, I think it's like the mix of like these two sides of him, where he's like, he is like a legit cool fighter. He can like murder anybody, all these powerful enemies, but he's also like a complete schmuck loser who no woman would ever be with.
He's like perfect man.
I was gonna say, like, in terms of just leaving off on this particular game, for anyone that hasn't played it, it's, you know, we're talking about a lot of silly stuff, we're talking about a lot of violence, but there's something to be said about, because Suda's such a film fan, you'll find a lot of parallels with Metal Gear Solid, with No More Heroes 1 and 2 to a degree. Well, pretty much the same, is that the voice acting direction is by the exact same person directed all the voice actors and I think all the Metal Gear Solid games, maybe not 5, but that's Chris Zimmerman Salter. And you'll find a lot of Metal Gear voice actors also appear in this. Like, as Manny said, Travis is voiced by Robin Atkins Downs, who also does Kazuhiro Miller. And you'll find the actor, I always forget his name though, that does the voice for Colonel Campbell in Metal Gear Solid, also has recurring roles as a lot of No More Heroes characters as well. And all the cutscenes are, they demand your attention. They're always shot so well.
It's super cinematic.
You'll see crazy camera angles you'll very rarely see in a video game. So when you're doing all this minutia to get enough money to fight the boss, go to the boss's, you know, dungeon, like, for lack of a better term, you'll want to see the next bit of story, because while there's like silly stuff that's like haha, Travis being a dork, fluffy stuff, whenever you get to a boss, you're always excited to see, like, you know, what that boss does, much like Metal Gear Solid. I think there's a lot of weird parallels between them, just like how Bob said, they're very Metal Gear and their backstories and their life philosophies. And it's one of those things that, you know, amongst all the jerking off jokes and body pillows and stuff, and that stuff is all fun. But I remember playing this for the first time, just going like, oh, I what's this boss's deal? Or what's Sylvia going to tell Travis next? Because as you're going through the game, the stakes are being raised every time you go up the ranks. And it's this thing that, again, Metal Gear kind of does with how its bosses raise in, like, you know, the threat that they pose. And it's a thing that No More Heroes does as well, 1 and 2. Not so much Travis Strikes Again, but that's a different game. But it's one of those aspects of this entire franchise that, you know, I don't think people talk about too much. They just kind of say, oh, it's fun to slice up things, and it is. But it's one of those, if this component wasn't there, this dramatic sort of, again, because Suda51 is a film fan, I think that gets thrown into the game a lot. And it's one of those things that goes, you know, it's like the end of a really good TV show. Like, oh, I want to see what happens next. Oh, I want to see what happens in the next episode. It has that sort of quality to it where you feel like every boss is its own episode. And it's all kind of linking up in the background. Stuff with Sylvia, stuff with Travis, stuff with the Assassins Association, and what this is ultimately leading to. It's that thing in the background that you kind of maybe don't realize as you're playing it with all the, you know, dick jokes and t-shirts or whatever, but it's I think it's what actually gives the franchise, like, you know, it makes it more than it's some of its parts, this weird assassin story that's being built in the background amongst all the, you know, funny fluffy stuff.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think, like, Suda51 is one of those people who I'm like, he knows what, like, coolness is. Like, he can make, he can be like, I'm going to make something cool. And then he does. And it's, like, the coolest thing you've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I think probably part of the reason these really cool assassin moments stand out is because there is all this really funny padding in between. And so it's like, you kind of, it, like, heightens the level of, like, the really cool action scenes even more, because you're just kind of going through this funny stuff, and then all of a sudden there's this really badass moment and you're like, whoa, wait, I thought this was just like silly game, but no, it's yeah, it's the, and again, it, a lot of it too leads to the character designs. Like, they're just so fantastic. Every assassin is so unique, and the voice acting, the cinematic cutscenes, it all like really just like comes together in such a nice little package.
Yeah, it is really bizarre to play a Wii game in the cold light of 2020. It's a weird experience. And yes, my Wii sensor bar was always on my TV. I don't know why. It's a tradition. It just goes up there. But yeah, like I had played it like over a decade ago, but I was still like, oh man, I love playing this game because there's always something new around the corner, and it's like something you won't see in any other game. And I feel like that is what made this game kind of timeless. Despite being tied to the Wii and its control scheme, it does feel like they could easily port this and it could be super playable again. And maybe by the time you're listening to this, they have done that already.
Hopefully.
Yeah, and again, those great cel-shaded graphics, it's such a good technique for it. And same thing with like Wind Waker, like it's gonna look good forever, like because of the way that those graphics work, they just look good always.
So the next game we'll talk about really briefly here, because we've been talking for a while already. No More Heroes 2 Desperate Struggle released 3 years later in January of 2010 for the US, and much later in Japan in October, so like 10 months later. 2010 was like arguably the last year the Wii truly mattered, but I guess No More Heroes 1 was big enough to make a sequel happen, and it's 2010, nobody has time for waggle, so they're just like, okay, you can just play the entire game with the classic controller, it's fine. And
it's terrible. Playing it with a classic controller is like one of the clunkiest things I've ever, like, if people want to play with a controller, it's fine, I guess. But you can tell that they're like, it was not designed for this. Like, I tried to. I was like, why? This feels so foreign.
I honestly didn't have problems with it, but I can see why you might prefer the original. It's just admirable that they were able to do that to begin with. But
I'm glad that they did it, though. You're right there.
And my experience with this game was, so like I beat No More Heroes 1 and I was like, all right, I'm into No More Heroes again. Oh, there's a sequel I haven't played. Okay, I can finally play it. I'm into this game. You know, I'm pretty good at No More Heroes. I'm ready for this. So I play the game, a little bit of it. I'm like, oh, wow. So it's just like the first game, directed by a different guy. And, you know, it's a little more polished. So, okay, I'm on board. And then I get to the second boss and he just destroys me. And I just get very frustrated and I keep playing. I lower the difficulty.
Nathan Copeland, the rapper?
Yes. Which
it is one of the most frustrating early boss fights. Again, it's if you can kill him really fast, it's not that bad, but if you're playing for the first time, like there's so many gimmicks to his stage that make it really, really frustrating.
It feels like so advanced for like essentially the first real non-tutorial boss fight in the game, and I pushed my way past that and I was like, all right, let's see more of this game. But like everything about this game was irritating me. And maybe it's just the state of the world right now, or just I was just how I was feeling. But like No More Heroes 1 was just soothing and satisfying and just a real fun, carefree experience. This game just felt like, again, just irritating in every way, in a way that I find hard to describe. I don't know if either of you had the same experience as me, but I appreciate there's more polish there, but there's just something about this game that feels more punishing and unfriendly.
I definitely think there's certain aspects of No More Heroes 2 that I prefer over the first one. Like the combat is more polished. You can switch your weapons out on the fly and the weapons are actually vastly different. You have a really long beam that's incredibly powerful but slow, and that can actually make short work of several bosses. Some of the bosses are just as good. Some are better than No More Heroes 1, while some are worse than No More Heroes 1. It's a game that kind of always pushes and pulls. I like this aspect better, and this one isn't as good. There's no open world. I can't collect as many t-shirts. The actual story is... It's slightly more obtuse than No More Heroes 1. There's some references to like movies that are going over my head. It is more unfriendly. It's a little bit more edgy, like not like a like cringe way, but it's more revenge story, which is not as interesting because No More Heroes 1, it was kind of like all over the place. You didn't know what was going to happen next, but and it has one of the most disappointing final boss fights of anything, really, unfortunately, because the game is all about the bosses, right? You have multiple playable characters, but it's kind of like a shit move where you get denied playing some boss fights because of this inclusion. There's all these little things that are weird and not as good, but at the same time, there's bits that I think are better. Ultimately, I'm really, really glad it exists. I never thought No More Heroes 1 would get a sequel. I think it's a game that I really wish Suda could go back to and maybe make some fixes to. I don't know what exactly, but it's the type of thing that if a No More Heroes 1 remaster is in the cards, I would love it if there was a New Heroes 2 remaster that, I don't know, fixes things, does something. Because it's a game that I played through it not even that long ago. I played through it like a year and a half ago, like from start to finish. And every time I finish it, I'm like, oh, this is not bad, but I just like it less than the first one.
And Maddie, did you ever play this game?
Yeah, I did. It's definitely, I haven't revisited it for a while. I definitely go back to the first game more often. But yeah, I think that maybe there's something about trying to polish this kind of weird game that ended up making it lose some of its charm. But I think, I don't know, I think going on to Travis Strikes Again, it went more wacky. And I think that was actually a more successful sequel in its own right. But yeah, I really hope we get a double port of 1 and 2, because especially with the Switch controllers, it's like so perfect for, you know, this game. And, you know, Travis Strikes Again was successful. And, you know, we're getting No More Heroes 3. So I think, you know, we're really ripe to get a port, because those games do not deserve to be stuck on the Wii. They need to be replayed and easier to access.
I totally agree. And to wrap up real quick, I do want to mention Travis Strikes Again, right? Travis Strikes Again. Oh, sorry. Strikes Back. Is it back or again?
It strikes again. Back sounds like it should be, but it strikes again.
So yeah, like when this was announced, so I interviewed Suda like in 2017 or 2016 for a website I hated. And I just did the interview because it got me out of the office. I never transcribed it because they wouldn't have cared about it. And that was after he announced like Travis is coming back. And when I talked to him about it, I'm like, oh, so new No More Heroes? He's like, I never said new No More Heroes. I said Travis was coming back. So
I remember this quote from something. I remember seeing this, and he's like, yeah, this isn't No More Heroes.
Yeah,
like, so it was something like that, where he's like, this is something going to be slightly different.
Yeah, so. it's a spinoff. It's like No More Heroes 2.5.
And because of that, I was like, oh, so you're going to cheap out. You're not going to give me the No More Heroes game I want. And then this was announced and like they showed off gameplay. I was like, oh, it's just a cheap twin stick shooter. Who cares? Snore. Moving on. And then it was on sale on Steam. And I was like, you know what? I'll give this a chance. And I have to say, this game rules. It's only a year old.
It's like part of it just lends it to the aesthetic. Like it's so satisfying to like look at. And it's like this, you know, it's like this whole kind of weird story about, it's like almost like this like weird Dragon Ball story about this kind of like arcade console of legend. And it's not like supposed to exist. It almost like reminds me of like, what is it? Polybius, like that, like urban legend about the arcade game.
Yeah.
And it's like, you have to collect these like 6 death balls and make a wish. And it's like, and then there's these weird like visual novel sequences that tell you the story. And it's just so... it's so special. And I think it's, you know, these are the kind of things that Suda51 excels at, is making these really unique, satisfying experiences that are like nothing else you've ever played.
Yeah, it is so cool. And again, it's a game from last year, so I don't know if it's right to talk about it here. But if you're a retro gamer, you're listening to this, it has so much like classic gaming stuff in it. And again, so many cool Suda touches. Like, you're waiting for those really cool cutscenes. I haven't played through the entire game, but like the cutscene for the second level is like live action. There's like, it's just so weird and neat. And again, new things around
like
every corner.
Yeah, it's like full motion video.
Yeah.
And like when you boot up the console, just like the boot up screen is like, it's, yeah, it just hits on all these really satisfying things.
I played through it when it just came out because I was obviously really, really excited. And like No More Heroes 2, there's parts of it I really, really like. Travis Strikes Again. And there's parts I was like, I think a bit of it is because if you're playing in co-op, this game does have two-player co-op. I'm sure it's really, really a blast. But I did find a lot of the combat sequences to drag on in certain levels. I'd say like 30% of the time I'm kind of like, I've killed all these waves and waves of enemies. Not that it's not interesting. I just kind of, it's almost like there is sections of No More Heroes 2 especially where the combat drags on and on and on, especially a parking lot sequence. I'm not sure if you got there, Bob, but like there's a parking lot fight in No More Heroes 2 that's literally, I want to say 15 minutes of stuck in this one parking lot.
That's far too much.
Oh, well, no. And I mean, definitely in Travis Strikes Again, the second game, which is like this like kind of puzzle thing where you have to like flip these tiles to get around this neighborhood. And there's these like giant like Dr. Manhattan heads that like slowly chase you. And it's like the most frustrating thing.
Yeah, I'm on that level now. Yeah. And I'm like, this is getting kind of long. Like,
It's super frustrating. But again, you know, I think where No More Heroes succeeds is in the aesthetics, and even when the gameplay is kind of clunky, you can really appreciate the other parts of it.
You definitely can, because it's all the story stuff that was still so weird. The visual novel stuff, I was saying how I'm like, you know, not a fan of The Silver Case or like Flower, Sun, and Rain, but I love the visual novel sections of this game. Some of the dialogue made me laugh out loud.
Like Gene just cracks me up in those sections. Oh my god!
And the art
to talk to you in this game.
And the art in those sections is so cool. It's made in the style of like, you know, ancient PC games, like pre-color PC games.
It's just like I don't know like how to promote this game more, but just the aesthetics of it are just so pleasing.
Yeah, I think it translates the gameplay perfectly to that this different genre. And just like every No More Heroes game, it's like flawed in some way. It's like not perfect, but I do like the jank.
Like, also kind of lends to its charm.
Yeah, like I do. The jank is why a big part of why I like these games. Like it does feel like a human being made this. It's not just like glossy corporate product.
Right. The only other thing, I'm not sure how you guys feel about this, but like the original, I'm not sure if you saw this, but the original idea that Suda had was this was going to actually, Travis was going to go to Hotline Miami and go to Shovel Knight. And was the original plan. And I think in an interview, like much, much later, like when the game had released, they're like, he's like, yeah, there's going to be no way that I was going to get all the approvals from the companies about how the game actually played in that style. Like there's going to be a 2D Shovel Knight section. He's just like, there's no way it would take forever to coordinate with all these different companies around the world and get that done. But that was what I was planning. But at the end of the day, I was like, well, okay, let me do something like that I can do, which I, for any creative, you need to be able to look, take a step back and go, whoa, this isn't going to actually work out.
Yeah.
Therefore, that's why I defaulted to just it being shirts, like Shovel Knight and Hotline Miami and Devolver shirts. And while that's absolutely the game I would have loved to have played, I have to respect, because I've had a project or two like this year myself from a creative way where I was like, okay, wait. let's slow down. Like, let's tackle this from a different angle, because we're not going to be able to do that. So that takes a lot of guts. And so I do really respect that he made that decision. Would I have loved like an actual Travis, little pixelized Travis in a Hotline Miami like world? They do, because you can see that in the game. They do have those top down sections where you're clearing out rooms after rooms in certain levels of the game. And I think with that plan kind of like not really, you know, sort of failing, like, oh, I'm not going to be able to do this, he did do an excellent job of trying to replicate different styles of games in Travis Strikes Again. So I'm glad it worked out. And because this game was a success, we're like directly responsible because Travis Strikes Again, Strikes Back, because it sold whatever Grasshopper needed to sell. It's why we're getting No More Heroes 3. So I'm super happy it exists.
Yeah, and on that subject, to wrap up, please, both of you, I want to know like what your hopes are for No More Heroes 3 right now. I don't believe there is a gameplay trailer out of this moment, but Maddie, you go first. Like, what are your hopes for No More Heroes 3?
Oh, man. I just, like, this is literally my favorite video game trailer that has ever existed.
It rules.
So, it's like this weird, like, it's like Ghibli meets E.T. weird, like, animated video that's just like this, like, weird movie trailer, and then it's like, oh, it's No More Heroes.
It's like, what if E.T. grew up and he was a jerk?
Yeah, and it's like, here, we're going to make this alien, and his name is going to literally be F.U., and we're going to call him Foo, and, like, I watched that trailer so many times, I don't even know what to expect from the game, but, like, all the alien designs are really cool. It's, you know, it's the same character designer. It's Travis fighting aliens in space. It's going to be ridiculous, and I'm just, like, super hyped for it.
And supposedly still coming in 2020, although that could change in the 2 months between us, this recording, and when the podcast goes live.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, most likely. I with that confirmation, because I saw that one screenshot, at the end of Devolver Digital's E3 stand-in presentation, where Suda's not standing in front of the fucking game screen, you can actually see it. I was like, ooh, that looks like what I want, because there's a mini map in the bottom left that kind of shows Santa Destroy, because he's standing in front of the motel. And I'm like, ooh, a return to the open world, that's kind of all I want. Like, it should be slightly better than the overworld in No More Heroes 1, but not too much better. So that was kind of like the thing that I really, really wanted to be in there, just to revisit that a little bit. And while I think the alien aspect is really cool for like a final boss fight or like the overarching plot, I still hope peppered throughout there are more like traditional, like assassin type enemies. It doesn't have, like, I don't want all traditional assassin type enemies, and I don't want all aliens. If they are, I'm still fine with it, but I just hope that there's like a mix, a variety of different boss types. And that's kind of it. Aside from that, much like Maddie, I'm like, I don't know what to expect, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, I'm excited. Hopefully COVID did not derail this game, but if it's delayed, maybe it'll be for the best. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. And to wrap up here, I also wanted to thank Mark Youngquist, a listener, because these games are very hard to find and a little pricey on eBay. He actually mailed me these games to play for the podcast. So without him, it'd be much harder to do this. So thank you to Mark for mailing those out to me. But yeah, as for us, we are Retronauts. You can find us on Twitter at Retronauts, and we are supported by Patreon, by the way. If you want to support the show and get some cool stuff, please go to patreon.com/retronauts. If you sign up for $3 a month, you'll get all the episodes 1 week ahead of time and ad-free. Sign up for $5 a month, you'll get that, and also two bonus episodes every month that are unavailable on the free feed. And we've been doing this since the beginning of the year, so there are quite a few exclusive episodes that you have not heard if you are not on the $5 level, because we've been doing a lot since the beginning of the year. So please check it out, either the $3 or $5 level, and we have more tiers after that at patreon.com/retronauts. Maddie, where can we find you, and what are you up to these days?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at the letter O, that's Raspberry. I'm always posting art stuff. I don't know what I will have by the time this goes up. I'm working on some Dragon Quest monster stickers right now, so those might be available. I also recently did some artwork for some vinyls that are being released by Ship to Shore Media, who do these really cool video game vinyl releases. They haven't been announced, so I can't say what games they're for, but definitely check them out. They're shiptoshoremedia.com. They've put out soundtracks for like Celeste and Mother and things like that, so they're a super cool company. I'm really grateful to have had the opportunity to work with them.
Awesome. Congrats on that.
Thank you.
And Matt, you've got a lot of cool stuff going on, including videos. As of this recording, Henry and I made a bit of a cameo in one.
Yeah, that would be in my episode of Talking Simpsons. I mean, Simpsons reference. I'm currently playing through. By the time people hear this, it should be all over with. But doing a playthrough of a Simpsons Hit and Run. So I have Henry and Bob make a little guest appearance. I've had some Radical Employees. Talk about, I'll be having some guest spots on that. I'm on Twitter at Matt Muscles. My YouTube channel is also Matt the Muscles. And if anyone is a fan of, you know, retro arcade brawlers like your Final Fights or Streets of Rage, I also helped produce a video game that recently got released on the Switch, and maybe by the time you hear this, on the PS4, called The Takeover. You know, spent a good amount of time building that, and there also will be a physical edition that should be out by the end of this year as well.
Oh, congrats. That's awesome.
Thank you.
So as for me, I've been your host, Bob Mackey. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo, and I have other podcasts outside of Retronauts, by the way. Those are Talking Simpsons, a chronological exploration of The Simpsons, and What a Cartoon, where we look at a different cartoon from a different series every week. You can find those wherever you find podcasts, or go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up there for all sorts of stuff, including exclusive miniseries, interviews, and so many bonus podcasts behind that paywall at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. So thank you to Matt and Maddie for being on the show, and thanks to everyone out there for listening. We will see you again very soon for another podcast. They watch their own mind.